Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So the community is smaller this evening for people who don't know about some of the things we do here. This is forest practice, so about half the community for this month will be not having to go to morning and evening pujas, and they'll still plug in with the work period and so on. And then in a couple weeks it'll change, and those of us who are all here now will be on forest practice, won't have to come down for morning and evening pujas. So there's a few things floating around the mind, what to talk about. One thing was just some of the joys of living in community. Sometimes people talk about the suffering of living in community, that living in community is really difficult, you really butt heads with other people, have disagreements, argue over views and opinions. But there's also many joys of living in community. So if people are generous with each other, kind to each other, so it can be a joyful experience as well. Went up to my kuti today, and there was a propane tank there. Somebody took away my empty propane tank, replaced it with a full one. So I didn't have to say anything. It just that brought up joy, just that somebody was kind enough just to think about checking and seeing if there was a propane tank that needed to be replaced. So somebody was being generous during the work period and going out of their way to do that. And then come down and Tanjivako hands me a piece of chocolate. Oh, okay. There's generosity. And walk into another room and Armand hands me a piece of chocolate. Then I go take a shower. Walk into the kitchen. Armand hands me a chrysanthemum juice drink. It's like, all right, just one act of generosity to another. So it creates a good feeling, community. Just giving gifts, receiving gifts. It's a joyful experience. That's such a big part of the practice, just giving. So in this tradition, the Thai forest tradition, there's a very strong ethos of looking after the senior monks or looking after the ajahns. So like Lungpur Pasano will have an upatak, Lungpur Liam at Wat Pa Pong, or any of the abbots of the monastery. And then we keep the Wat Pa Pong tradition here of if you're over 10, you get an upatak as well. So everybody gets trained in it. Some monasteries, only the abbot has an upatak. So we call the attendant monk the upatak. Some places only the abbot has an upatak, but here and at Wat Pa Pong, Wat Nanachat, then if you're over 10, then somebody will attend to you. So almost everybody gets trained in it. So this is just patipati puja, is offering up your practice for the sake of others, or giving your practice, giving yourself as an offering. So that's in stark contrast with like practicing just for the sake of yourself or trying to get something. Like there's the whole like the me and my practice ethos. So trying just to get something for oneself. That's usually not such a joyful experience. Or even if it is a joyful experience, then it's left, something's lacking, something's left missing. But there's this strange shift that happens near do something for somebody else, or you give your practice as an offering either to your teacher or to the Buddha. So there's an interesting shift that happens there where you're coming out of oneself. So that can happen with anything, whether it's upatakking or doing service for the monastery or just doing one's own sitting and walking meditation at the kuti, but doing it as a sense of an offering, then it changes things quite a bit, and usually the quality goes up. So it's kind of like if you wanted to offer food to somebody else. So like if you want to eat food yourself, or you're hungry, so you want to make some food for yourself, you might throw something in the microwave or some top ramen or something, or you might go to McDonald's or Burger King, get some food for yourself. But if you have a guest or your teacher, then you're probably not going to take them to get fast food. You're going to make something nice for them. So it's the same with Patipati Puja, offering your practice for your teacher, for the Buddha. Then quality might be a little bit higher than if you're just doing it for yourself. And so in the monastery, it's also a real sense of family. So like at this point, I've been here for, say, 14 years. And then I view Lungpa Pasano as like a father figure. And that's just ordinary. So I've spent more time physically being around people in this community than I have with my own parents at this point. Just have the meal together, the morning and evening pujas. So we're practicing together, cultivating the way together. So it builds up a sense of like a Dhamma family. And the way the practice works is interesting because it's the external manifestation of our practice, like the formal practice would be sitting and walking meditation. So that's like you could say that's the core of our practice or the formalized version of our practice. Do lots of walking meditation, lots of sitting meditation. Like Lungpor Liam would say for himself, just something he would do for fun sometimes is he would just sit for 11 hours, just kind of because it was interesting just to sit for that long, see how long he could sit for. So that's amazing if we can do that. But also we have to make every activity into practice. So if we're not doing formal sitting and walking meditation, then we just have to remember a lot of these principles of practice. There's an interesting sutta I just read where the Buddha he talks about right concentration. And then rather than saying right concentration is doing so many hours of sitting, doing so many hours of walking, he's always pointing straight back to the heart. He says, what are five factors that make it impossible to have right concentration? One can't endure various sights. One can't endure various sounds. One can't endure various smells. One can't endure various physical sensations. One can't endure various tastes. That makes it impossible to have right concentration. What makes it possible to have right concentration? Then one can endure various sights. One can endure various sounds. One can endure various smells, one can endure various tastes, one can endure various physical sensations. If one can endure those things, then it's possible that one will develop right concentration. So that's that whole idea of not allowing oneself to be bothered by things or not making a problem out of things. There's a story Tenzin Dun told when he was visiting here in 2013, that when he was newly ordained and living at Wat Bapong, there was this monk who sat behind him, and he didn't name who this monk was, but monk who was just junior to him, who sat behind him and had something strange he would do, where he would, Ajahn Dhan would be meditating, and then that monk would be behind him, and he'd like pull on his robe, and so Ajahn Dhan would turn around, "Don't do that," and then just keep meditating, and then he'd pull on his robe again, "Don't do that," and then it would happen over and over again. Then he'd kind of like blow on his head, and "Don't do that," and then he'd just keep meditating. And Ajahn Dhan said he just tried to keep his mind equanimous the whole time. Is it, it happened for months. This monk would just kind of every meditation, just pull on his robe. And Ajahn Dhan would just turn around and "Don't do that," and just keep meditating. And then after that time went by, this monk went up to, at that time, Tan Dhan, and said, "You know, I've tried that with a lot of different monks, and you're the only one who didn't get angry. You're the only one who didn't have a aversive reaction to that." So that's that sense of enduring various sights, various sounds, various smells, tastes, tactile sensations, and just being able to abide with equanimity in the world around us. There's always going to be good and bad sights, and good and bad sounds, and so on. Or it's like we were talking at tea time, like in Thailand, how they, it's so much quieter here at Abhayagiri than most monasteries in Thailand, where it's just this unbelievable blaring all day long. It seems like 24 hours a day over the loudspeakers in the village, either making announcements or playing music. But we don't have to make a problem out of it. So you can still practice with that. You can still abide with that. We can spend all of our time trying to run here and there, trying to get the perfect conditions, trying to live with just the right people that never criticize us, never act in ways towards us that we find disagreeable. We're just never going to find it. It's like there's always going to be somebody who rubs us the wrong way. There's always going to be some circumstance which is irritating. It's always going to be some sort of condition which doesn't live up to our standards. So just equanimity, just being able to develop right concentration in any circumstance is important. And so just thinking of like training or cultivation. And Lungpor Cha said that if you haven't practiced to the point of weeping at least several times, you haven't really practiced. So it's not that we're going to be able to have equanimity right away. We really have to go through the peaks and valleys of practice. We might be incredibly diligent with our sitting and walking meditation and just keep running up against a wall. It's like, I haven't attained the goal yet. What's happening? What's the deal? I think it's just important to just have what Master Hua called a long-enduring mind. So it's just having that attitude that even if it takes my whole life, even if I get first jhana when I'm 80, even if I have to wait till I'm 80, then that's better than if I didn't practice at all. Who knows how many lifetimes it would take. So just having that sense that no matter how long it takes, and everybody has to just start where they are. Some people are going to have more barami, more or less barami. Some people are going to be able to develop their meditation quicker or slower. Some people are going to be able to be more diligent in their practice than others. But just being able to move forward from wherever we're at. The Buddha said that one of the signs of a great person is that they make an honest assessment of where they're at and they work from there. So not overestimating ourselves, but not also selling ourselves short, or realizing that we have this ability. All of us who are already here in the monastery, we definitely have the ability to practice. Just the intention to even come here and keep precepts is already something extraordinary, unusual in the world. So So there's no doubt that everybody here has more than the ability to practice and cultivate the way. And we just keep moving forward, no matter where we're at. There's always going to be difficulties, and we might have a plateau in our practice. Things are going well for a long time, and then suddenly we take a dive into a valley. We just keep moving forward, just keep cultivating. That's just so important, not to give up. Sometimes conditions just might even seem to be totally against us, and we just have to. That's one reason we have precepts, is just to get us through these really difficult periods. And I guess some people, you know, won't really go through difficulties. Some people might already have enough barami or spiritual qualities that they won't really have so many difficulties in their practice. It might just be a steady onward and upward. But for most of us, there's peaks and valleys. I remember one time when I was living at Pujamgam. I was there, it was January of 2010, I think. And I was there on my own for a while. And I had, actually this must have been January 2011, because a few months before I had dislocated my shoulder swimming in a pond at Pujamgam. And so I was kind of, my shoulder wasn't recovering so well, and still wasn't really able to use my left arm so much. And it's January, and Ajahn Pasano was going to visit Pujamgam, so I wanted the place to be clean and tidy for him. And he was going to come there for 3 days, and he had a really full-on schedule, so I just wanted to make the time really restful for him, and that he wouldn't really have to do anything when he was at Pujamgam. No teaching engagements, just able to take a rest and have some time to himself. And he was going to show up with Tansambajano, was his upatak at the time. And so I put forth a lot of effort that day to clean the monastery with my one arm, and clean the kitchen, just sweep the paths, just do what I could to make it nice to receive him. I also moved out of my kuti. So since I was injured, I was staying down at this kuti made out of brick, which is down below in the main area near the sala, near the meditation hall. And so I moved out of my kuti and went onto this like platform, so just staying outside. So I was in a lot of pain, and then really tired. Ajahn Pasano showed up, and then it was also, the day he showed up was the day we would normally chant the Padimokkha. But if you have only three bhikkhus, you just do what's called parisuddhi, so you do a very short, truncated version of the Padimokkha. So I thought, oh, okay, that's going to be easy. But then at the last second, a fourth monk joined in, and so we were going to have to chant the Padimokkha, and I was the only Padimokkha chanter, and I was really, really out of practice, plus just really tired and kind of out of it. Plus, I didn't want the Padimokkha to drag on, because it was going to be late at night. I knew how tired Ajahn Pasano was going to be. And so I thought, okay, well, I'll just have to chant the Padimokkha. And so the fourth monk that showed up was this senior monk, so I also wanted to kind of prepare things for him well. And so it was maybe like 9 p.m. and we're getting ready to chant the Padimokkha. And so I started chanting, and I was just making a lot of mistakes. And this other senior monk who had come was checking. So when we chant the Padimokkha, there's a monk that has to, it's about a 45-minute chant in Pali for those people here who might not know. It takes about 45 minutes, chanted quite fast in the Pali language. And there's a monk who has a book that checks, and so if you make a mistake, he'll correct you, and you have to go back and do it correctly, and like go back one or two lines or so and chant that correctly. So I was making just mistake after mistake, making a lot of mistakes. And by the time I got about halfway through, I just completely faltered and was so nervous. And then this senior monk was giving me kind of a hard time, like, come on, you know, you're in front of your teacher here. Like, what are you doing? And so I just started faltering, and I just kind of couldn't keep going. So then I asked Ajahn Pasano's permission. Can I just read it? I just can't do it. I'm sorry. And so I just read the rest of the Padimokkha, but I felt really bad. And then after the Padimokkha, Tantsa Bhajano went with Ajahn Pasano to his kuti to get him set up there. And I was with this other senior monk, and he was just ripping into me, just telling me how inappropriate it was that I chanted such a bad Padimokkha in front of my teacher. And I already felt really bad and was in a lot of pain. So I just, I was thinking I was about to break down. And then he went back, and I was sitting by myself in the Dhamma hall, just reflecting on what a terrible monk I am. And then Tantsa Bhajano came back, and he's like, you forgot to give a bath towel to Ajahn Pasano. He doesn't have a bath towel. Where are the bath towels? And I almost, oh my God, I just didn't show him proper hospitality. Terrible Padimokkha. And that kind of broke me. and so then I kind of head hanging, like they say in the suttas, like head hanging, shoulders drooping, abashed. And so I walked over to this platform I was staying at, and then it got really cold in the cold season in Thailand in January. So then I was thinking, okay, I'm not going to go into my kuti. I'm just going to go onto this platform. And I said, oh, I forgot to get blankets for myself. And there was this cold wind coming up, and I just got onto my platform and was thinking, like, okay, I'm going to go to sleep now. And I was just shivering and kind of feeling like just depressed, abandoned, miserable, cold, physically and mentally uncomfortable. And then just completely broke down, just started bawling, just sobbing. And then I thought of this story of Ajahn Chah, where something similar happened to him, where he had been outside of a village and they were having a festival, and how it started raining, and he was just sitting in the rain, and he just felt so alone, and how he just started sort of crying to himself and then just telling himself, just, you know, like, screw these tears, just let them dry up, just let them just cry till the tears are all gone. And so I thought of that story of Ajahn Chah in that moment and thought, okay, well, I'll tell myself something similar to that and just cry till the tears are all gone, just never mind. And it was whatever, 30 or 40 minutes, and things sort of dried up. And it's kind of an empty feeling after that, but also a feeling like a good feeling in conjunction with that. Just that, okay, well, you know, that's the practice. That's how the practice has to be sometimes. You give it your all. You give away everything you have to others. You have nothing left for yourself. And then you even give away your spirit. There's that sense of even giving away your spirit, and then there's just nothing left. And then you cry, and the tears dry up, and there's something bright there that remains. I think that's a really good place, a good reflection, a place to where people can. It's a place to try to go in the practice. There might be a fear there to not want to suffer too much, but like Lungpur Liam gives this teaching over and over again, you have the suffering in front of you, and you place the suffering in front of you, you place the dukkha in front of you, and then you just go through it, and that's how you practice. It's also kind of like the Buddha said, like, it's rare that people set out on the raft towards the other shore. What most people do is just keep running back and forth on this shore. So rather than keep running back and forth on this shore, it's an adventure. You set out. And so our formal practice is sitting and walking meditation, but then the other things that we do, whatever it's work or what we might call quote-unquote worldly activities, really we can have the same spirit of relinquishment and letting go in any activity, and we make it into Dhamma. If we don't do that, then we're no different than a construction worker or a computer programmer or whatever out in the world. But if we use it in terms of giving and relinquishment, then we can bring that into our practice, make that into Dhamma. And anyone who practices is going to suffer. I mean, that's normal, but it's also something that we want to go through. It's also like something they teach in the Tibetan tradition, which I really like, is that if you really practice, then when you die, you won't have any regrets. And it's really important that we get to the place where there's no regret. So, kind of tired today. Don't really have so much to say. So I don't think I'll give a very long talk. I'll just leave it at that this evening. Hopefully, this can, whatever's encouraging, just take that, and whatever doesn't make sense or is discouraging, maybe just leave it for now. Okay.
Sadhu, sadhu.